Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Robert Alexander, author of A Kitchen Boy, a novel of the last czar. Robert Alexander is the pseudonym of R.D. Zimmerman, who has written several novels in the Todd Mills detective series. Is Innuendo the most recent?
Innuendo is the most recent, right.
What happened? Why are you writing this under a pseudonym?
Basically, when you switch categories, there are two reasons, but primarily when you switch categories, publishers want you to use a different name. And I was doing mysteries, did a number of mysteries under the name R.D. Zimmerman, both the Todd Mills series, which featured a gay television detective, and then a number of other mysteries. But then I switched to The Kitchen Boy is historical fiction, and they wanted a new name for that. The other reason, and has purely to do with marketing, is shelf space. I got terrible shelf space with the name Zimmerman. I was always at the end of the shelf on the bottom row.
But there's no disguising. I mean, it's
no.
The copyright is R.D. Zimmerman, and it pretty much lets you know who you are.
Right. It's just purely for those other reasons, just for so when bookstores order, they know there's two different categories. One is one type of book. Another is a mystery.
But that means, to some degree, you're going to lose your regular readers.
I suppose in some way, yeah, because Robert Alexander, who is Robert Alexander?
Right.
The book's been doing extremely well, I think primarily because of interest in the Romanovs. So I have lost some of my readers, but then somehow the word gets out and people find out. I don't know how, either through the wonderful mystery bookstores around the country or whatnot.
So. Let me ask you this. I have a friend who writes fantasies, and she was going to write a big, different kind of fantasy, and she was told she could get more money in an advance under a new name because it was a new start.
Oh, you know the business, don't you? This is getting down to the dirt that the authors always talk about.
Does this mean that you got more money as Robert Alexander than you would have as R.D. Zimmerman?
Not because of the name change, but because of the different category. Historical fiction is a much larger market. And I got, you know, much larger advance. The book is doing much, much better. It was up on the New York Times bestseller list a few weeks ago, primarily just because historical fiction is a bigger pool or a pond than either the mystery market or the gay mystery market. For me, the issue, being a gay writer, having done my last series being a gay mystery writer, it sort of smacked of going back into the closet. And I really had to wrestle with that one until I talked to a lot of straight mystery writers. When they write outside of the category, they use a different name. Some mystery writers will continue to write in the mystery field but do so under a different name because of wanting to get more money, because they're a new name and they've got sales figures attached to their old name or the real name. But Ed McBain writes under two names. For me, it basically just comes down to different category and better shelf space.
So what happens if you write a historical novel with gay themes? Then what do you do? Are you R.D. Zimmerman?
No, Robert Alexander.
You stay Robert Alexander.
Yeah, and to me, it's, you know, I thought, now am I going back in the closet on this, or what am I doing? You know, it's not one less gay writer. R.D. Zimmerman is a gay writer. Robert Alexander is a gay writer. Alexander is a family name, actually. Robert is my real first name. So it was just like, you know, how do we do this? This is a different category. What do we, you know, it was just a general discussion.
R.D. Zimmerman, Robert Alexander, let's talk a little about The Kitchen Boy. It's the story of the last days of the Tsar. Not too long ago, I read a nonfiction book, interviewed the author, Robert Massey, The Romanovs, the Final Chapter. Are you familiar with that book?
Oh, yeah. I've underlined it. Robert Massey is one of my favorite all-time authors. I've read that book. He did a lot of forewords for, like, Tsarina Alexandra's diary and whatnot.
The Kitchen Boy tells the story of the last days from the perspective of a person named Lyanka, who is a kitchen boy for the Romanovs. Did Lyanka exist?
Yes, he did. Actually, I've read all of Robert Massey's books, and this has actually sort of determined the course of my life. After I read Nicholas and Alexandra, I started studying Russian and so on. But to get back to your question, a few years ago, I was reading a re-release of Tsarina Alexandra's last diary. She kept a daily diary for the course of her life. That book had a foreword from Robert Massey, and I got down to the last couple of lines on July 16th, two lines before the last pieces that she ever wrote. And Alexandra mentioned, you know, suddenly and oddly, our kitchen boy, Lyonka, was taken away. Wonder whether we'll ever see him back again. In fact, the Romanovs were taken down to the basement and shot 4 hours later. And the kitchen boy was taken across the street to the guardhouse and then disappeared after that.
The rest of the kitchen boy story then is invention, his past and so on?
Well, what happens after that? Of course it is. You know, but I, you know, when what I read was that the kitchen boy was taken across the street to the Popov house, which is a guardhouse. People remember seeing him lie in a cot with a guard's coat over him and crying, and then the next day he vanished. And no one's ever really come clean or knows what happened to him after that. So my fascination with the story is, what's the angle? How do you come at this book? Who's going to tell the story? And then I started looking at this kitchen boy who was born in 1904, and I thought, you know, in 1998, that guy could easily be alive. I knew my great-great-aunt Flora, who was born during the Civil War. And you get these leaps of, you know, centuries and times. And I thought, this was somebody who was not only knew the Romanovs, but lived with them for the last year and a half of their lives. And I thought, this is the angle that I want to come at. He knows what they were going through.
Well, what prompted you to write a book about the Romanovs, a historical novel?
Well, I mean, it's always been a fascination with me. It's how I got into Russian language. I read Nicholas and Alexandra, started studying Russian in high school, became a Russian language major and a creative writing minor, and then I studied in Leningrad in 1976 and then went back in 1978 and worked for the U.S. Information Agency. So I've been going to Russia. I owned a business over there for about 12 years in St. Petersburg, partners. My domestic partner here and our Russian partner there own a business in St. Petersburg. And all along I found, you know, kept up on the Romanov books. There's so many out there, and they're so wonderful. But when I just saw that line in that diary, I just thought, you know, this is an angle that hasn't been explored. And then I started thinking about it. You know, there's so many facts and figures about the Romanovs, everything written from a nonfiction point of view. I wanted to use the magic of fiction to try and fill it out, to add another facet.
Various elements of the story, I assume, are real. Now, it's been a while since I read the Romanov book, and a lot of the listeners, of course, have not. So let me throw a few at you. According to your book, the daughters and the Tsarina all sewed jewels into their gowns to such a degree that when they were shot, it took extra bullets to kill them. Is that true?
Totally true. The Romanovs, they had gotten rid of or given away with nuns the larger jewels, a total of about 80 pounds, and I'm talking about 80-carat diamonds, 100-carat emeralds from the time of Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. These are, you know, Romanov czarist jewels. They kept with them 19 pounds of diamonds, and these diamonds they sewed into their clothing, and you can read the Tsarina's diary, and she had a code word. She said, I arranged my medicines with Tatiana, sewed my jay. You can watch this whole history of her over months of packing their corsets with layer after layer of diamonds, which sadly and in effect turned the corsets into bulletproof vests.
Now, the story of the notes that went back and forth and the nuns, who apparently may or may not have received them. That's also true.
It's also true, yeah. Those notes, secret rescue notes, still exist. They're in the archives in Moscow. And the Romanovs received a series of four secret rescue notes.
And all of the people in the book are real?
All of the people are real, yeah, absolutely.
According to your book, when they found the corpses, the two corpses that were missing were Alexei,
The Tsarevich
and Maria.
Right.
And they still have not found them?
No. Essentially, the book is a dramatization. It was like if you would see a movie of a non-documentary movie. It's a dramatization up till the end and what happens to the bodies, and that's the fictional spin on it. But the grave of the Romanovs was not found until 1991, and when they opened this rut of a grave that had been hidden from 1918 to 1991, unknown and unfound by anyone, they opened it up, and there should have been 11 bodies for the Tsar and the Tsarina, their five children, and then their four servants. What was missing, however, there were only 9 bodies, and when they did all the research and the DNA, missing definitely is Alexei the Tsarevich and then one of the daughters. And the Russians all believe that it's Maria because their way of coming at identifying the corpses. Some people believe it's Anastasia, but I go with the Russian point of view that it was Maria.
In addition, the story of what happened to the guards, what happened to the ones who
the
were sent off, the
yeah.
commandants, that's all real.
That's all, yeah. There was Commandant Yurovsky. He was the last commandant. Avdeyev was before him. There were a series of guards, and they all, essentially, after the end of the Romanovs, met terrible, awful deaths. Many of them perished at the hands of Stalin. Some of their children were sent off to the Gulag for 20 years.
The entire book takes place in a frame. And in the framework taking place in modern day, there's a box of Fabergé eggs, 8 of them, I believe. Are those Fabergé eggs actually sitting in St. Petersburg, or are they still missing?
They're missing. There were a total of, I believe, 56 Fabergé eggs made for the imperial family, for Alexandra and the Dowager Empress Maria. Diamond, platinum, ruby, I mean, just spectacular things. They've accounted for all of them but 8. Many of them are in Richmond, Virginia, at a museum. There are, you know, other collections, but 8 are missing. And whether they've been broken up or they're hidden in a private collection, no one knows.
So the idea of a box containing all the missing materials is kind of serendipitous for you as a writer.
Well, you know, you look at this stuff. You've got missing jewels. You not only have missing Fabergé eggs, you have, you know, a 38-pound a suitcase is still missing. They found one suitcase in 1933 of missing gems. The other suitcase of 38 pounds of these gems, worth $500 million to $1 billion, it's gone. You know, you look at that fabulous wealth that's gone, you look at the fall from power of Nicholas and Alexandra, and then you've got 2 missing bodies. You know, essentially, I mean, it doesn't get any better as raw material. You can't make up stuff like this.
There are some surprises at the end of the book.
I hope so.
which kind of, you know, bring the whole thing together. Did those surprises exist as you sat down to write the book?
You know, I think any book evolves as you go along. It's like if you were going to go to Europe, you pick a route that you want to go, say if you're going to do a driving trip through France, and then you get to a certain point and you think, that road looks more interesting down there. And I can't quite recall how things evolve, but I, you know, everybody thinks, you know, in a former life I was, you know, a prince or a, you know, somebody, or I was a singer, or I was, you know, somebody wonderful. Well, in fact, you know, that's just a few people back then. What if in a former life you were somebody not so great? And this, of course, involves some of the twists in the book, which I can't go into anymore without wanting to give it away.
When you're writing The Kitchen Boy, Robert Alexander / R.D. Zimmerman, when you were writing this book, was it a completely different process from writing your Todd Mills books?
Well, I mean, it was a different process in that I had to do just months and years and so much of research. And it's much more atmospheric. When I sat down to write this book, I wanted to sit down with the absolute authority. I wanted to write it. It's a fictional eyewitness account of the last days of Nicholas and Alexandra. And so when I sat down, I wanted to know as much as if I were an eyewitness. I read all the memoirs, all the diaries, all the notes, all the photographs. The Romanovs were fabulous photographers. They left behind 150,000 snapshots, per se. I knew all that, so that was a different, it was more of an atmospheric thing. But then, still what I like in a book is a strong sense of story. That's what a book is to me. It's not great writing, it's story. It's taking me somewhere else. And so I wanted to continue along. I mean, that's my training, my background in mysteries, is the pace and the plot. I could go it at a slower pace in this book because the emphasis was more on the atmosphere and being there. So there were different things.
This is nuts and bolts. How do you determine pacing? How do you determine pacing, say, when you're writing a Todd Mills book, say, Innuendo, the most recent one? How do you determine pacing there compared to The Kitchen Boy?
You have to look at, you know, the different requirements. I mean, just to, like the requirement of a joke is that it ends on a punchline and the punchline is funny. So you're building up to that. When you're writing a mystery or a thriller, you begin each chapter with a hook, something that's going to hook the reader at the beginning of the chapter and say, okay, I got to finish this one chapter. And then it goes through, and then you actually end the other thing on just another kernel or another morsel, something to pull them along to the next chapter. And so it's a hook and pull and a hook and a pull. It's much more subtle with a piece of historical fiction. I do think that you can ignore story. You know, I mean, at the very opening of this book, the first paragraph, when the guy says, "My name is Mikhail Semyonov," to me, that would fit in any mystery book, actually. It'd be just because of the dynamics. And, you know, he confesses that he was the kitchen boy. He's an old man now. And he says at the very end of that first page, There are two children missing, and I know what happened to them because I took care of them with my own hands. And now, if I were to pick up a book on the Romanovs, I would find that irresistible. So I sort of wrote the book that I would want to read about them.
You're listening to an interview with Robert Alexander, whose book is The Kitchen Boy, a novel of the last Tsar. Compare that to, say, working on a Todd Mills book. What becomes the difference there? I mean, you don't have, obviously, when you have somebody really interested in the Romanovs and you set it up that way, you're going to pull people in.
Right.
When you're writing a Todd Mills book, how do you do the same? How do you accomplish that when all you've got is a detective and probably a murder?
Well, usually what you start out with a murder is that you have a murder on the first page or the hint of a murder where you have great suspense right on that very first line of the very first paragraph on the very first page. It's much more action-oriented, I would say, much more, you know, what's going on in the plot rather than internal or atmospheric per se. Then with the Todd Mills series, of course, there's the gay element because Todd Mills is gay, and you can't let any of that bog down the pace of the plot, but it's an atmosphere of itself. It's a type of book that you've got to have an issue of the character be, you know, either have that just recognized and have it not be an issue, or there's an issue relative to the gay community.
Does that become constraining?
Well, every book's constraining because it's just like, you know, like I say, like a book's got to be funny or a joke's got to be funny to be a joke. You know, a gay mystery, per se, has got to have mysterious elements. It's got to have tension, pace, and plot, and it also has to have, a gay theme to it. Does not have to have gay sex in it unless somehow that furthers the plot. You know, like in the Romanov book, The Kitchen Boy, it's got to have atmosphere of the Romanovs. It's got to show us something new about them. It's got to take us to Russia. It's got to be authentic. And you have to be incredibly precise and accurate because there are a billion people out there who follow the Romanovs like nobody's business.
So where does art come in? Does it come in?
Oh, sure it does. You know, it's like clay. I mean, it's, you know, when you're building a pot, you have to find clay that has the right texture, that is the right density, that can be fired at the right temperature. Those are all the materials. And then you pick them up, and that's where the magic comes in. I don't know if it's art. I think it's more magic.
One of the differences that I see in looking at, say, your other books compared to this is this, you have everything charted out. Once you've determined what your twist is going to be at the end and how you're going to play with that, the book almost writes itself, or seems to.
Well, I wish it had been that easy. you know, originally the book was twice as long. It's now 230 pages. It was 460. And I alternated the chapters between the present and the past. And mainly the long struggle was, how am I going to tell this story and from whose point of view? I wanted it so that Misha would be talking from the present back into the past. Because I like those layers of saying, like, you know, that he could comment on how he went into a room and saw somebody, and he would know that that person's daughter, and be able to comment it on the narrator, would end up in the gulag 30 years later. Or, you know, I mean, just the different layers of reality.
Are Misha's opinions about what Tsar Nicholas did wrong, are those R.D. Zimmerman's?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, those are the ones that I read about. You know, I put it all in there about what Nicholas did wrong, what he did right, what he was like as a person. I've a greater degree of respect for the Romanovs after I wrote the book than I did before.
Did you do any research in St. Petersburg?
Sure. I traveled to St. Petersburg about once a year, and I went to the city archives, and I visited, you know, their apartments in the Winter Palace, of course, and then the Alexander Palace where they last lived. But then more important, I did research with my friends over there talking to them about how they view Nicholas and Alexandra. And then a whole other aspect was my desire to try and bring in the levels of the Russian soul, which are so incredibly complex. And I wanted to try and capture that from Misha's point of view. I didn't want to write it as a Midwesterner talking about them.
Did you get out to Ekaterinburg?
When I was out in that area, when I was posted in Kazakhstan, and then I was in Tajikistan when I worked there, Ekaterinburg was a closed city. It's only recently been opened in the last 10 years. I was off limits to foreigners, and so I didn't. And the House of Special Purpose was torn down in 76, so there's not too much to see. There's another book, The Fall of the Romanovs, published by Yale Press. In it, they have a collection of eyewitness accounts of those nights. And I got out maps and I got out photographs of that period and of that time of Yekaterinburg and plotted it all out. And in The Fall of the Romanovs, you can read the Yurovsky note. Yurovsky was the commandant, and then he recorded everything that happened that night.
Was there anything you wanted to put in but felt that people would come down too hard on you, some fictional element that would have been fun to put in there, but you knew you couldn't?
I wanted to stay true to their days and their times, you know, like when they go into the washroom and there's profanity written on the wall. That was accurate. Their little dog was killed at the end of the book, and I had somebody after reading saying, oh, why'd you have to kill the dog? And it was like, because the dog was killed. I mean, where I had fun was, you know, there's one scene at the beginning of the book where they are all lined up for breakfast, and then one of their other dogs, the English Spaniel Joy, who did exist and, in fact, was the only one to escape and eventually made it all the way to England, brought a rat into the dining room and let it loose. If that had happened, I know that's how those people would have reacted. The girls being princesses and very closely guarded, you know, screamed and ran about. Alexei was a very bored young boy. He was 14, but he was in a wheelchair because he was hemophiliac. He would have gone after it. And Alexandra would have been terrified that in his chase in his wheelchair after the rat, that something would have happened and he would have hurt himself.
When you go back to Russia today, what do you see, and how do people relate to the Romanovs as opposed to during the Soviet era?
History is a luxury of the present, and Russians, as I know them today, don't have that luxury yet. They're very concerned and consumed by maintaining a roof over their head and food on their table. They just don't have much time otherwise. They're also coming out from under the cloud of what they learned from their Soviet history books that portrayed Alexandra as a traitress to their country, as a woman who slept with Rasputin, and Nicholas as weak and pathetic and indecisive. So they don't have the facts with which to deal with, and so they're still, you know, why should we be interested in them because they were such pathetic people? But I think it's the new people now, younger people, who are emerging and have the freedom to look at it. You know, some people have said to me, you know, "Как стыдно, мы так мало знаем," how shameful it is that we know so little about this. And they really do.
We know a lot about what, we hear a lot about what Russia was like during the Soviet era. I was there in the late 60s and for a couple of weeks, and we know about the transition phase. But what's it like in St. Petersburg today?
Moscow and St. Petersburg are doing quite well, but there's a terrible donut effect where they're the donut hole, and then you have this great vast country ringing them where they don't have the wealth of Moscow or St. Petersburg at this point. The smartest thing I've ever heard about Russia is that it's a new country every 3 months. It's changing that quickly and that dynamically. People are traveling abroad. They're getting a glimpse of the West. They like what they see. They come back. They want to replicate it and give it to their people. So it's coming along. It's going along in the right direction.
How do general people view the old communist regime?
I'm glad it's, you know, done and over with. The young people are, you know, and I'm saying like 50 to 60 and underneath, are glad it's done and over with. They had enough of it. Let's get on with our lives. They want to live well. They really don't care much about politics in so much that they just want to have a good life. The older people who are on fixed incomes are indeed having a horrible time of it. They have a great deal of nostalgia for the days when they were taken care of, because now they're maybe getting a pension of $10 or $20 a month.
How did they view the United States, Bush?
Well, Americans have always been popular. The closest I'll ever come to feeling like a rock star and a movie star and anything glorious is being in Russia, particularly in the 70s and 80s. You were like you had just fallen from the moon and you knew the greater truth of life and let me touch you and isn't this fun? And Americans are still extraordinarily popular and viewed as, I mean, there's a very great deal of openness of our character and an openness of their character where Americans and Russians bond, find a common territory.
How do they view Bush? I mean, do they know that he was not elected?
I don't know. I can't say for sure, and certainly in a great mass, you know, culture popular way, I've heard, you know, negative things about him, and then I've heard Russians also historically and traditionally from the days of serfdom love the strong hand of a master, the crack of a whip. And so there are some people that, you know, I mean, this is, I know, a perverse way, but that's how Peter the Great reigned and how Stalin reigned, was by severity. And so I politically, I couldn't comment on that.
Robert Alexander, R.D. Zimmerman, any interest from Hollywood on the Todd Mills series?
There has been, and I've heard more baloney from more people more often. And I just said, it's like, show me the money. You know, I mean, I've gotten calls on Christmas Day saying, we love this book. We've got to have this book. Get your lawyer on the phone. And I mean, do you know how expensive it is to get a lawyer on Christmas Day? I'll believe it when I see it.
And what about The Kitchen Boy?
The Kitchen Boy, I have high hope. We all have high hopes for, and there's no deal signed as of yet.
What are you writing now?
I'm working on another piece of historical fiction, again in the Russian vein, but more than that, as Austin Powers would say, I don't want to mess with my mojo on it.
Well, what about working as R.D. Zimmerman in mysteries?
I'll go back to that. The primary reason that I jumped from mysteries into historical fiction was that there was a break, and that break was caused by when my publisher, my longtime dear publisher, Dell Books, was bought out by Bertelsmann Books and absorbed and dissolved into another one of their imprints. So all the editors that I had worked with for so long were fired, and this is the path for now, although, you know, I think I'll probably go back and forth.
R.D. Zimmerman, Robert Alexander, is there a book in the back of your head that you could talk about that you haven't written that you really want to write but you're not ready for, or the work you're doing prevents you from writing it?
Well, there's nothing preventing me from writing anything now. There is a book, a family memoir, that I want to write. There was a great vein of alcoholism that ran through multiple generations in my family, and it's something that I want to explore, not only because of the confusion that it entailed and left behind, but also because of the gifts that it left behind for me. Because seeing people, my father is an alcoholic and died 35 years ago, from that horrible experience, what I salvaged from it as a writer was the ability to look at anything and immediately question, what if? When I was with my father, I would worry about, you know, what if he drove off the road? What if he missed the step? But I was able to extrapolate that aspect and turn it into fiction, because now I can look at a story and say, well, what if this happened, or what if that happened? And that's how you make a story. That's how you build it, is not to look at something literally, but to keep coming at it from multiple different angles and aspects to try and find something interesting, a way into it.
You've been listening to an interview with Robert Alexander, whose latest novel is The Kitchen Boy, a novel of the last czar. Most recent Todd Mills mystery under the name R.D. Zimmerman is Innuendo. I'm Richard Wolinski on Cover to Cover.